check rides were turning out badly, and I feared the worst, namely that I'd end up getting a check ride from that terrible man, Lieutenant Forager, and I knew that if that was the case, there was no way in the world I could do anything for that man once he started shouting and hollering at me, which he certainly would do. He always did. That was his way. So my flying in general wasn't very good, and it wasn't getting better, and it wasn't acceptable. At times like this, I'd seen it in the past. One's roommates and friends become enormously supportive, and they spend a lot of time being nice to you and encouraging you and doing everything anybody could do to help person through these episodes. We'd already lost one roommate a month or so before who had been washed out and was totally brokenhearted about it, as anybody would be. Well, I don't remember all the details about this anymore, but I remember that I did get my check ride with Lieutenant Forager, and he really took me over the coals, and the long and short of it was he flunked me. So that meant that I was finished, except for one thing. In order for that to happen that late in the day, because I was practically through by that time at primary flying school, you had to get a check ride from the commanding officer, Captain Hoglan himself. And this was slated for a Sunday morning. But I was not as worried about that check ride as the others, because I knew that Captain Hoglan wasn't likely to be abusive and mean. He might be stern and severe, but I'd seen enough of him to think I might have some chance of flying properly for him. I ought to point out here at some point Captain Hoglan spoke with a slight lisp. Well, nobody was flying at this time, and I went out on the appointed hour, and several of my friends were there. My instructor, Mr. Howard, was there. Bless his heart. None of them said anything. They were just being supportive. So before we got in the airplane, Captain Hoglan told me exactly what he wanted me to do, which maneuvers and in what order, and the whole bit. And he said, "You take me up and you do these things for me." It was a beautiful, sunny, bright day. And I went up and I did what he told me. And I didn't find any of it very difficult, and it seemed to me that it went pretty well. And we came back and landed and got out, and he said, "Didn't anybody ever teach you to slow this airplane up before you turn onto your final approach?" And I said, "No, sir, I didn't think they had, nor had they. I never remember that." Well, he started going over my maneuvers one by one. He said, finally, "Now you're lay the eighth." And there was a dreadful pause, because I'd forgotten to do lazy eight. Totally forgotten it. He said, "You didn't do lazy eights, lay the eighth," as he called it. I said, "No, sir, I forgot." Well, he looked at me and he said, "Now listen to me. When you get to basic flying school, you can't do silly things like that. Do you hear me? You have to remember to do what you're told." And he walked off. But the minute he said, "When you get to basic, Well, that ended that unhappy episode, and although things didn't always go as well as I would have liked, I never had again in flying school or elsewhere, I guess, to go through that kind of ordeal. And it was an ordeal, I'll tell you that. And my friends, of course, they were terribly delighted and hugged me and everything. It's all quite nice. And Mr. Howard was terribly pleased. He grinned from ear to ear. And I can't possibly say that I was as happy for him as I was for myself. That obviously wouldn't be true, but I was very happy that that I had made it, because I suppose it's a blot on an instructor's record, and I just don't think he wanted that to happen, for that matter. Well, a couple more things, and thus we'll end the business about primary flying school. I still didn't have my 60 hours, and there were a number of us who were short our time by very little amounts, half an hour and things like that. But it had to be done. You had to get your 60 hours. And it was customary at primary flying school that your last flight, you would ride in the front seat and the instructor would ride in the back seat. Well, the last day there was for flying was raining. There wasn't a particularly low ceiling, but it was raining quite markedly. But the visibility was all right, and it was decided that we'd fly rain or not rain. And the wind was from a different direction from I ever remember it's being from, and it meant that when I taxied out in the front seat and Mr. Howard behind me and turned to the far side of the field and turned to take off into the wind, I was headed right for one of the hangars. And Mr. Howard said, "No, no, you're not to do that. You go off to one side. You don't want to take off right into the buildings." So I could see that was a sensible thing, and I turned and started taxiing along the edge of the field until I got to a place which I thought was all right, but it actually wasn't all right, and I was still not totally clear of the hangars. I suppose I thought I was, or thought it was good enough or something, but he grabbed the stick out of my hand, shook it violently, and hollered at me and said, "When you go to make sure of something, make sure." Well, I got the message, and we had our little flight in the rain. It wasn't the first time I'd flown in the rain. Actually, we'd done it several times, but of course I wasn't in the front seat. Anyway, we finished up our time, and that ended that. Probably the night before we left for Shaw Field, everybody got assigned to different places. I might interject this here. Not everybody got assigned to different places, but people got assigned to different places. Now, Shaw Field, I better explain, was down in Sumter, near Sumter, S-U-M-T-E-R, South Carolina, and was about 30 miles away from Camden. Shaw was a brand new airfield, brand new. And it was big, very big, and I might interject here that Shaw Field is still an active Air Force base. Anyway, I was assigned to go to Shaw Field. Most of us were, maybe all, for all I know. But I was, and all my closest friends were. And anyway, the night before we left for Shaw Field, left Camden, the Air Corps, I suppose, had a big beer party for us, all the graduating class, or graduating from primary anyway. And it was a beer party, and it was held on the base. And All the officers were there. In fact, they were there. I don't know that any of the civilian instructors or people were there at all. I can't remember they were. All I remember about that party, really, was that old son of a bitch, Lieutenant Forager, and he was carrying on there with a long spiel surrounded by admiring cadets. I was one of them, but I wasn't admiring. But I remember his saying, I don't get any kick out of this work I'm doing here. He said, I want to aviate. I want to really aviate. I want to aviate. Well, he may have aviated himself right up to heaven for all I know, but I know. I did forget to mention all along that there was based at the at Camden a BT-13, which was a basic trainer, an all-metal plane, a good deal bigger and heavier than anything we flew, but the same one we would be flying at basic flying school. And that was there for the purpose of so that the flying officers, Captain Hugland and that Forager and the rest of them, could get in, keep up their proficiency in something better than a PT-17. And I remember admiring the airplane, and it was brightly painted with the nice old red, white, and blue colors that the Air Corps used to use in the old days. And it had ACTD painted across the tail, which stood for Air Corps Training Detachment. Camden, South Carolina. Well, I don't know who drove me down to Shaw, probably De Azevedo. There were a great many differences in basic flying school, but the biggest one was that this was a completely military outfit. There were no civilians there. The instructors were all flying officers, and we lived in regular Army barracks and ate in an Army mess hall, and the mechanics were all enlisted men, and the whole place was run by the Air Corps. There was no civilian involvement. The airplane, the BT-13, which was made by a company called Vultee, I've never heard of them for years. They were a subsidiary, I believe, of Consolidated Aircraft. Anyway, the BT-13 was considerably more airplane than we had been used to. It was, as I said, all metal, probably twice as powerful. It had flaps. It had full instrumentation in the back seat. And it had a constant speed propeller, I think. I don't believe it did, you know, come to think of it. I don't believe it did. I think it had just the only choice. You had a choice of high pitch and low pitch. And nothing in between. That's what I think it had. Anyway, and there was a regular control tower. It had radio. The airplane had radio in it and all that stuff. This was a real down-to-earth, business arrangement. So it was very different in that respect. And again, there was an upper class there. We were the second class ever to fly out of Shaw Field, but the previous upper class, which would have been 42E, was there. But again, we were still on a 7-day training basis, and either they flew in the morning and went to school in the afternoon, or flew in the afternoon and went to school in the morning, and we did just the reverse, so that the field was utilized all day. And the instructors, as I said, were flying officers, second lieutenants. We were assigned to a barracks, which was a standard GI-issue military barracks, and there were three of us in one room. I don't remember those people too well. One of them, his name was Arthur Lovelace, and he was a kind of, I think he might have been a rat or at least a mouse in a former life, but he was a perfectly nice guy. And again, his father was a sergeant or something in the Army. So he was an Army brat. The other person, in addition to myself, was a boy named Brown, who was a hunky blonde number. And I remember Brown chiefly because, aside from the fact he was very good looking, he slept naked. And every morning when he woke up, he would be lying there in bed with a huge erection. And he would, well, the first thing that happened when the bugle blew or whatever happened to wake us up, Lovelace would sit up in bed and say every morning of the world, "Well, shittin' two is eight." And Brown would wake up and he would look at his big dick standing up in the air, and he would start slapping at it and saying, "Get down, get down. I don't know what's the matter with this thing. Get down." And somehow under those wild circumstances, we managed to get up and get dressed and get in formation and march to breakfast and come back. And as I said, either we flew in the mornings and went to school in the afternoons, and then after a week of that, we would go to school in the morning and fly in the afternoon. We also started getting a link trainer practice. A link trainer is a simulated sort of airplane. It's a hydraulically operated thing, and it enables you to learn the elements of instrument flying without actually being in an airplane at all, or wasting gas, or risking your life and limb, and so on. I never quite enjoyed it particularly, but it was rather good fun. And it was a very beneficial kind of experience. The first instructor I had, I forget his name, but he was a second lieutenant, and he was a nice enough guy, but he was really sort of, I don't know. He was a little bit Mickey Mouse. And one thing became apparent early on was that he was absolutely terrified of flying with cadets. When we first flew the BT-13, this was a totally new experience, and I would say that it was a far bigger experience aviation-wise than than the transition from no flying at all to a primary trainer. This was a good deal more of a change than that. And I remember somebody telling me once when I was in primary flying school, they said, that's the biggest change you'll ever have to make. You'll never graduate to another airplane again where there'll be so much difference between the two. The first place, the airplane was much bigger. Second place, it was a single-wing, low-wing monoplane with a much more powerful engine. It had flaps. It had a propeller that went from low pitch to high pitch. Visibility was poor. It had a radio. It had all the instruments in it, and so on. Well, we had a certain number of hours in which we were supposed to solo, and it became apparent. We went over to the Sumter Airport, which was a dirt field, to practice landings, and it became apparent to me that Lieutenant whatever his name was going to take his sweet time about letting me solo, because he was scared. He was scared of everybody, and we all had the same experience. But eventually he gritted his teeth, I suppose, and got out of the damn thing and said, "Now you take it around." And I had long been ready for that, even though the Sumter Airport was rather small and you had to mind your P's and Q's to get the airplane in there, and it was too small to land and then just go ahead and take off again. You have to stop and taxi back and start all over. First place, it had flaps, and you landed with full flaps, and the flaps you cranked up, and it took forever to crank the things down to crank them back up again. So since you didn't want to take off with full flaps in a running takeoff, why, you would just about have to taxi back and do that all over again anyway. All of my best friends were there, as far as I can remember. Charlie Smith and Snuffy Smith and Joe Hensler and De Azevedo, whose first name, I think it was Joe, too, escapes me. Bostic was there. Bennett was there. Everybody I knew well was there. And ground school was a little more difficult, and we started to have to learn Morse code and all that stuff. I never did learn it, incidentally. I don't know how I passed the course, tell the truth, but I did. I think a lot of this could be summed up by saying that at primary flying school they taught you to fly an airplane, period. But from then on, it became more a process of learning how to do things with an airplane. In other words, they assumed you knew how to fly, which meant you could land and take off. But you needed to learn to do a good many more things than that. I guess basically you were supposed to learn how to make the airplane do what you wanted it to do. I would think there were probably four major things that we learned at basic flying school. One was navigation, cross-country flying. Another was instrument flying. The third would be formation flying. And finally, night flying. As a matter of fact, in looking at my logbook, I'm quite surprised how quickly these things followed one upon another. I see that I made my first cross-country flight on March 29th, did my first night flying on March the 30th, did my first formation flying on March 31st, and then I see here April 9th, night landings. So all these things followed one upon the other pretty rapidly, apparently. I want to pause at this moment and go back in time a little bit to catch up on something I forgot to say in its proper place. We had some leave given to us between the time we finished primary flying school and the time we had to report to Shaw Field for basic flying. And I don't remember a great deal about this except that I took a bus, I guess, home and had to stop somewhere in North Carolina, Asheville maybe, probably, to change buses, and there was quite a long layover there. I was in uniform, of course, because you weren't allowed to wear civilian clothes at any time. Didn't even have any with me. So I spent the time between buses wandering around, I suppose in the vicinity of the bus station. But anyway, I remember quite well that at some point or other, this youngster, I suppose he was a high school kid, undoubtedly was, came up to me and he said something like, "Excuse me, sir, may I speak to you?" And I said, "Well, of course." He said, "Are you an aviation cadet?" And I said that I was. And he said, "Well, some of my friends and I, we want to become aviation cadets when we're a little older, and I wonder if you would talk to us." And I said, "Well, certainly." And he went and phoned his friends or something. I don't know. There were three or four boys appeared there anyway, and they took me to a cafe or a restaurant or someplace and bought me something, I don't know what, ice cream or whatever, and plied me with questions. And to what degree I was aware of it at the time, I really don't know, but clear enough to me now that I was a big hero to them, And they were filled with awe and excitement at being able to talk to someone who was actually involved in this business. Long and short of it was that I found it a very pleasant experience, which, as you see, 40-some years later, I've not forgotten. I got home to Harrisonburg, alas, just in time to act as a pallbearer at Aunt Dede's funeral. For the benefit of those who don't know who Aunt Dede was, she was my mother's aunt. My mother's mother's sister. And a dear lady who spent a good many of her last years bedridden, but never seemed to lose her patience or anything. She was always a terribly frail little thing, and eventually she died. Anyways, when I got home, she had just died, and since I was there, somebody thought it was be a good thing for me to be one of the pallbearers. I believe that's the first time I ever served in that capacity. I did so. The only good thing about it was the fact that it brought Hansen home, and I got a chance to see him. But not surprisingly, he was not in much of a joking mood at the time, and I could hardly blame him. I also, at that time, am pretty sure that I went down to Williamsburg, where they made a big fuss over me, and some of my professors and friends took me out to lunch one day. And that was a marvelous experience. I think I must have spent the night down there. I probably spent it with Ted Rust. And I was feeling quite depressed for some reason, though these fits of depression used to come over me from time to time. And I was probably as used to them as you can get. Anyway, I remember Ted saying to me at one point, "Well, I don't quite know what it is you want. You certainly wouldn't want to return back here." And I admitted that I wouldn't. Anyway, I don't remember anything else, but I suppose I took a bus back down to Sumter, South Carolina, or someplace, and went out to the field and began the adventure in basic flying school. The routine at basic flying school was much like it had been in primary as far as hours were concerned, but I noticed that from my logbook that I flew a good deal more on a day-to-day basis than I had in the past, sometimes 2 or 3 hours a day. And I'm sure I enjoyed that. The family had some friends in Sumter that I had known for a number of years, although not very well. My mother had a first cousin at home named Agnes Lewis, and her parents lived in Sumter, the Moses, Mr. and Mrs. Moses, and they were marvelous people and invited me and my roommate, one of them, Don Baker, to dinner on several occasions. There was also another family in Sumter who were relatives of the Moses that I knew a little bit, or had known a little bit in the past. Their name was Moise, M-O-I-S-E. It was a rather large family of man and his wife and several children of various ages. And they were extremely nice people, some of the nicest people in the world. And I used to like going to their house and just sitting around and being with them. And they always made a big fuss over you and so on. They were, knowing them and being able to visit them from time to time was always a great pleasure. All in all, at Shaw Field, I got in a total of 72 and a half hours flying time. Some things I found very difficult to learn. One of them was instrument flying. The way this was done, in addition to getting practice in the link trainer, then you would fly with the instructor in the front seat and you would be in the back seat, and when he got up to a certain altitude or whatever, why, you would pull a curtain over the canopy in the back seat so you couldn't see out. And then the instructor would have you practice flying on instruments and doing various maneuvers and so forth. Sometimes it was easy and sometimes it wasn't. I was in the hospital for a couple of days once with bad cold or something of the sort, and when I went back to flying, I wasn't altogether with it. In addition to that fact, that was the fact that I had come back to find that my flight instructor had been transferred.